politics without the soap opera, with unfiltered constitutional conservative truth. The Conservative Review with Daniel Horowitz.
And welcome back, fellow American patriots and Minutemen standing at the ready to focus on the issues that matter in the way they matter, at the time they matter, because I know you guys have no time for nonsense, distractions, grift. You want to have it given to you straight. What's going on? What are the biggest issues? What do we do about it? Continuity of ideas, strategy, follow-up. We do it all here at CR Podcast every day, but certainly today, Wednesday, March 27th. And I was going to have a guest on today, but I'm going to push it off till tomorrow. We're going to talk about the International Health Regulations, WHO, just some more things on threats to medical freedom. Honestly, there's so many things to cover. I don't have enough minutes in the day. It's kind of hard to do the job of an entire movement without a staff. But this is the problem. We focus on words, not deeds. We focus on the latest distraction, then we never even follow up on it, then we never even formulate ideas about it, and we just go on and on and on. And then the more ineffective we are, the more crazy some of us get, act out in a way that appears to be white trash in front of the public, so then we lose even more elections, despite the fact that broadly the public agrees with us on the issues, and rinse and repeat. We're in this vicious feedback loop of failure. Failure electorally, failure on issues, failure on outcomes. We have a movement that wields influence over what it doesn't have influence, but then where it doesn't do anything. So I'm going to be a little bit all over the map today. I want to talk about some stuff going on in the courts, continuing our theme of the courts being a one-way street, a one-way ratchet against conservatives, including Republican judges, particularly the three Trump-appointed Supreme Court justices. And what do we do about that? Because that's a big problem. If the left continues to violate civil liberties at a federal level in the blue states, and we don't have recourse in the courts, but then those same courts are come after us when we try to govern in red states the few times we do, where does that leave us? If we believe in judicial supremacism, but only a version that's a one-way ratchet. We'll get into that. We have the Francis Scott Key Bridge being destroyed. And 24 hours later, I have no more news for you, unless you guys have news. Literally nothing. It's so weird. It just goes into a black hole. It used to be it was 1 or 2 day news cycles. Now it's a couple hours. It was done. Okay, well, What happened? What caused it? Do we even have the name of the pilot and the crew? I don't think we do. We do know that the vessel was involved in another major crash in Antwerp, Belgium, about 8 years ago. I don't know if it was the same crew, but again, was this cyber terrorism on the navigation system? Was it incompetence? And is incompetence now endemic of operators of major infrastructure? I don't know. I mean, it's not a loaded question, but we literally don't even have anything. It's just got pigeonholed. Okay, so we just move on. Like, we move on from COVID. We move on from Hawaii. We move on from the Vegas shooting. And again, what that does is, because you don't have sane questions being asked, some people have all sorts of crazy theories and gets discredited. And then, you know, people don't like the right, so they don't care even more, because that's kind of what a straw man opposition is. You know, Chris Rufo said something very interesting on Twitter that's important to bring to the forefront. And Chris is one of the few people we have that are serious doers. He's very much responsible for a lot of the education policies for DeSantis. He doesn't work directly for him, works at the Manhattan Institute, but he's really been leading the charge to get the rot cut out of public education. So he's not just, you know, some guy giving an opinion. He's actually on the playing field doing things. There's very few people I could say that about. He made the following observation. We have a problem on the right. The economics of online discourse are increasingly at odds with forming and mobilizing a successful political movement. How cogent. Cogent, sagacious statement. Very, very cogent. The economics of online discourse are increasingly at odds with forming and mobilizing a successful political movement. Now, Chris is not saying, oh, I'm sick of these online crazies, white trash. You know, I want to just be a normie GOP. No. I mean, Chris is like me that, broadly speaking, I don't know about some of the specific theories on certain specific issues, but generally speaking, I mean, this is the rise of the Fourth Reich. We have very serious problems affecting every aspect of our life, liberty, property, society, culture, health, viability as a society, ability to afford living, demographics, invasion, the political persecutions. So we need a serious, successful formulation and mobilization of a political movement. And we're trying to do this every day. You know, yesterday we had Adam Morgan on, one of our best Freedom Caucus guys, chairman of the South Carolina Freedom Caucus, running for Congress. Think about how articulate he was. He's more red-pilled than any Trump MAGA guy. He actually gets it done. He actually has turned South Carolina politics upside down with what he's done there. But does he come across to your normie suburban voter as white trash? Not at all. That's what we need. Look, we're already in a situation where we're treading on thin ice. We're coming decades into a fake opposition, so therefore Democrats have successfully implemented immigration policies, education policies, welfare and healthcare policies that have created dependency that have really made it very hard for any conservative to win. So, you know, it's going to be narrow no matter what it is. We're done with the days of 1980, 84, 88 style wins. But my gosh, you don't come in front of people just stupid. Another interesting observation he made, he starts talking about Tucker and how important Tucker was as kind of the leader of conservative media, and basically gently notes what we have noted for a while, that he circled the drain, went downhill when he went to Twitter from Fox rather than getting better. For those wondering, there is a structural as well as an ideological challenge for Tucker on X, Twitter. The primetime Fox spot was, you know, his previous job was regular, time-bound, and coordinated the whole movement, offline and online, with the prestige and production of a cable news network behind it. Tucker on X is too fragmented, lacks the nightly rhythm, and the topics have been all over the place with some serious missteps. I say this as a huge admirer of Tucker's and hope that he continues to experiment with the format and pick up his role as a coordinator and kingmaker on the right. He's trying to be gentle, as you can tell. But it's just crap. There's no follow-up. There's no continuity of strategy. There's no focusing on the issues when we actually have votes coming up, actually have primaries. Nobody has matched what we have done here so far. Matching the intensity of trying to find ways to focus on specific primaries, to focus on systemic solutions for how to win primaries, like changing party rules to state conventions, focusing on the legislative sessions, bolstering the Freedom Caucus. I mean, think about it. The Freedom Caucus, by a mile, is the most successful institution we have in the states. Why am I the biggest cheerleader in the country of that? Why isn't Tucker promoting that? Again, the economics of online discourse are at odds with forming and mobilizing a successful political movement. I can't tell you how much time I've spent. You know, I'm rushing into this show without a clear mind. I usually like to clear my mind before I give over stuff to you. I've just been focused on so many disparate issues, trying to follow up on every one of our beats, on immigration, on the states, on the primaries, on judicial supremacism, court cases. And again, all with a forward-looking mindset of what we need to do about it, not just, hey, this is a nice story, or this is something that's catchy, and this is something good to report on. I've never had this many Windows and Word documents out open in front of me, slowing up my computer. And I'm just struggling. I don't know what we do. There's a lot we can do if we had a movement. But we don't. So we keep getting the same results. By the way, a lot of people are talking about RFK's VP pick. It's irrelevant. Notice I haven't talked much about him this entire year. I never trusted the guy. Look, if someone's frustrated with the two choices, they want a third party just for the sake of it, I respect that. I'm just telling you, he could have been that guy, Ross Perot on steroids, but like everyone else, he gets caught up in the razzle-dazzle. You just want to be like everyone else, like the Israelites and Judges. God says you're going to be a different sort of country, a different sort of civilization. And they come back and like, no, we want to be like all the other nations, have a king. We don't want, you know, a Samuel, an inspirational leader that's a decentralized republic under, you know, the auspices of following the commandments of God. We want a king. Want to be like everyone else. So it's like everyone they get gun shy. Oh, I'm going to be there. Oh, actually, I'll just nominate a leftist with money to be my VP. And notice he hasn't really led on much. I said this at the time when people in the medical freedom movement, a lot of the doctors we had on the show were getting roped in with him. I said, look, it's not just on other issues that DeSantis would have been better than RFK because they were sucking all the oxygen out, focusing on RFK. I said, even on COVID, on vaccines, DeSantis will deliver much more. And that was RFK's signature issue for many years because there's no shortcut to someone actually standing in the breach, getting in that position and following through. I don't think you understand how hard that is. The pressures to focus on the razzle dazzle and do it the way everyone else does it. It is so great. In a vacuum, there's nothing so great about DeSantis's governorship, or it shouldn't be, but it is. I can't find anyone else coming close. And by the way, speaking of a narrow path, I mean, I must say, what he's done electorally in Florida is pretty remarkable, alongside what he's done policy-wise. You know, today he's going to be signing the first bill to protect landowners, homeowners from adverse possession, you know, squatters' rights. Every day, there's something else there. And yet, he's in his sixth year there. There is no movement to try to match that with another governor. We just continue going on and on. Nothing. By the way, the RFK VP pick is all the more proof that the state freedom caucuses are the only thing we have. There's such desperation for mainstream acceptance that once you get into a position of authority or influence, you just can't actually make the play that you always talked about. There's something that's standing on that field that you just act the way everyone else does. That's why the Freedom Caucus is so important, because they're upending the way we do business and they don't care. And that's what we need to celebrate. Again, I have this all the time in primaries where we'll have candidates and there's no rap sheet on the guy. It's not like I could point to, you know, either let's say he was in a legislature or maybe he never was, didn't have a record. You know, it's not like he said or did anything bad on guns or taxes or whatever. Or, you know, he seems to be a decent Republican in good standing. And people are like, well, Daniel, what's wrong? He's not good for you either. Like, he might be decent if we had good leadership. But if you want to upend the system, he's not going to do it. Again, we had this in Ohio. I talked about some of these races. People are like, oh, these guys seem good. I was like, okay, did they pledge to join the Freedom Caucus? No. Did they get money from the CLF? Yes. So, you know, I can't find anything bad they've done or said so far, but you send them to Washington, they're not going to be with our guys to upend the system. So it's empty calories. It's worthless. If you have a guy running that you know will do that, I mean, that makes a big difference. Remember, headed forward, with this red-pilled rhetoric. Again, rhetoric. You're increasingly going to have very few Republicans like Lisa Murkowski or Mitt Romney that openly run on them, although I would argue that they are the Mitt Romneys of 2024. Remember, everyone's a big hero now, like I say many, many times, on Mitch McConnell, but at the time when I was challenging him in, you know, 2010, 2012, 2014, that era, people looked at me like I was from Mars. Like, what? I mean, I understand we have Lincoln Chafee, we have Lisa Murkowski, we have Susan Collins, but he's a good, you know, strong Republican. Like, what's your issue with him? People didn't understand that. If you're not actively putting the people in who will actively do things to change the trajectory, we are like Flight 93, where you're going down. If you don't get someone in there to grab the yoke and get it up, you know, everything else is the same result. You could either do nothing or get someone in there who doesn't know what he's doing, get someone in there to yank it down even more, sideways, upside down, in and out, do whatever. But there's only one thing that's going to work. And that's finding some areas of the country to get the right people in to make the right plays. And that requires a movement to have the proper focus of, you know, what are the policies we want to do? What are the strategies we want to implement them electorally and legislatively, legally, culturally sometimes? And follow up, continuity. Otherwise, we're just going to continue spinning our wheels. So again, I mean, on the key bridge, even here locally, you know, they talk about the logistics, the ramifications of the bridge being down, but what exactly happened with that ship? Who are they? Who's the pilot? Again, as of 24 hours later, as of right now, maybe it changed by the time you hear this. There's the only thing I could find is the story, which is very disquieting, that this same cargo ship was involved in an accident 8 years ago. You know, we have some very serious issues. Again, a lot of this is still speculation. It could be this was a total freak accident in the mechanical maintenance of the ship, and it's no one's fault, and it just happened to come in at the worst time, at the worst place. I'm not being sarcastic. That does happen. You know, the last time was like 44 years ago in the Tampa Bay Causeway, the Sunshine Causeway. But the devastation wasn't nearly as bad because that was just a random place in Tampa. This is like a major artery on I-95 going to a port. So, you know, we ought to know what's behind this. And speaking of Florida, that's why competence is so important. You know, DeSantis is conservative, he's right-wing, he's based, he's whatever, but he's also competent, and that's something we do need. There's a lot of serious questions that we have a bunch of boobs, DEI hires, or just a bunch of idiots in general. We have a mentally ill, drugged-up society. Then we have all these foreigners we bring in, we don't know where they come from. Who knows who's running our critical infrastructure? These are just things to think about. Again, I'm not making any accusations because we don't know anything. We see a ship hit the bridge. That's all I know. You know, it likely wasn't terrorists on board. I mean, I think we would have known that by now. It wasn't blown up. I mean, it was strong enough to knock it over. I think, you know, I see some people are like, oh, well, you know, how could it knock it over? I was wondering at first too, but it's pretty clear once you see how much weight that ship was and where it hit. You know, everyone I spoke to, my dad, ironically, he's a mechanical engineer who worked at Bethlehem Steel, which was the main thing on the other side of that bridge in Sparrows Point in the 80s when I was a kid. He didn't work on the bridge in the 70s, had nothing to do with that, but he's very familiar with that sort of stuff. And, you know, he made it very clear that obviously it, you know, it didn't bother him. He was actually bothered by the Surfside building, incidentally, how that came down bothered him, but not this bridge, the way the ship hit it. But again, I mean, the lights went out twice, power went out twice, and the ship steered in that way. Was this a cyber attack? If not, I mean, we don't have the proof it wasn't or was. We can't trust our government anymore, and I understand why people have all these theories, because they've lied to us with mass genocide. I mean, forget about the vaccines, even the virus itself, to this day, we have not gotten to the bottom of that. We know it was man-made. We know they're made, and we know they have all these other biolabs that they're making viruses. There's no effort to stop it. You know what I'm saying? Like, forget about the vaccines. The vaccines is a little bit tough because you're not allowed to even recognize the problem. But the virus, you know, we're told the virus is the worst thing in the world, right? Everyone knows about that. It shut down the world. It was the worst event in world history. And yet we've not rectified it. It's continuing. We're funding it. Because when you have an ineffective movement that's distracted, stupid, gets too extreme and conspiratorially too quickly beyond the Overton window sometimes, but doesn't do what we can do, focus on what we can. It's just all over the place. So the common denominator is the left continues doing their stuff. And we continue to suffer from all the downstream effects of bad public policy without any redress. This is going to continue. You know, last night, the Democrats flipped. This is very important. Democrats flipped a legislative seat. It was an open seat, but it was a Republican seat in Huntsville, Alabama. And I've noted before that it's not like, okay, we're losing the blue areas. We're losing the cities and even suburbs of cities in red states. And I don't mean like Dallas, Houston size, but Huntsville, Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama. I mean, obviously, the inner city of some of these places are very black, but I mean, even the surrounding white areas we're losing. Trump only carried it by 1 point, this district. Republicans usually carried the, you know, I think last time they maybe carried the legislative seat by like 9. They lost it by almost 30 points last night. You know that? Now, a lot of people are saying the IVF issue loomed large because of the Alabama court ruling. And yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, those who think that's important, I respect their pro-life view. But it is kind of stupid if that's going to be your lead, you know, issue. It's not going to win very electorally. I just don't think it's wise to lose everything else on that. But, you know, in general, it's part of an uninterrupted chain of special elections that clearly demonstrate a bad environment for Republicans, not a good one. And again, like we've said, even the media is now picking it up. The pendulum has swung back, but the polls show Biden winning. So what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do? We're now going to lose the power structure of mid-sized cities and suburbs in red states? I mean, that's what's going to happen if we continue with this do nothing, accomplish nothing, have no narrative, the few issues we glum onto, we get distracted, don't follow up, don't pick a fight that's going to harness national attention either with a federal budget fight or a multiplicity of red states taking action. And just focus on Trump's white trash comments, incoherent nonsense every day. Allow Trump to endorse every piece of crap, but then endorse against DeSantis candidates that are 10 times better. Are we really going to continue this? And that leads me to really kind of the main topic today, the courts. We've talked about this a lot the last couple weeks. There's yet more important news in the courts that Trump's 3 picks were imbeciles. And I don't say this to even beat up on Trump. That's not really the point. The point is, what do we do about it? Don't lie to ourselves. Oh, we have a conservative court. No, no, no. We have a big problem in the court. I now have several dozen examples of hypocrisy particularly those three judges, to varying degrees, where they are now allowing the feds and blue states to do egregiously unlawful things without the Supreme Court interfering. But then when it comes to red states doing good things, they interfere with alacrity and they contradict themselves with values of, you know, procedurally standing, circuit splits, or just in terms of the contours of state powers versus individual rights, upside down, inside out. With COVID, they're not there for individual rights, but somehow when it comes to drag shows, they are. And the tranny stuff. And of course, illegal immigration. So late last night, the Fifth Circuit officially, formally denied Texas' request to put SB 4 back into effect. As we predicted, the Supreme Court pressured them. So now, basically, the Fifth Circuit's taking their cues on the Supreme Court. So we now await a merits argument next Wednesday. And it looks like they will likely appeal. Texas will seek review en banc. So hopefully en banc works better. It's not such a great panel they got here, but this ruling is a very bitter pill because this ruling, like I said, was inspired by Amy Barrett's concurrence where they did a rope-a-dope. Officially, they allowed SB 4 to go into effect. But in fact, what they did was signal to the Fifth Circuit, we're not going to, you know, lock it up. We're not going to, you know, keep the injunction, but we'd like you to do it. That's basically what they said. That's what Amy Barrett and Kavanaugh did. Well, fast forward, on that very same day, we had oral arguments in this mifepristone chemical abortion drug case. And what it demonstrates is this gross hypocrisy of judges like Kavanaugh and Barrett on how they are working overtime to ensure that we don't get conservative victories politically when it intersects with the courts. But then, meaning they're taking this basic approach, basically like this. When we come crying to the courts because we're aggrieved, they're like, shut up. You don't have standing. We're not some sort of super legislature. Take that up with the political branches. Well, all right. You know, as you well know, those of you who have listened to me, read my book, I'm very sympathetic to that argument if we actually applied it evenly. But no, because you see, anything we want to do in a red state gets taken down, like we see with SB 4. So the problem here is you have to diagnose what is going on in the courts. And then I've noted this before, but I'm going to reiterate today, it informs a very clear solution of what we need to do about it. But if you continue to go on and say, it's terrible, the Democrats are delegitimizing the point. No, join in with them. They pressure the courts. We should do the other way. Delegitimize them. They respond to pressure. So, and again, I just want to, before we get into the minutia of this case, of Alliance Hippocratic Medicine v. FDA, Texas case on this mifepristone abortion drug, but just understand the vitality of this issue. We cannot move on until we come up with a strategy to deal with this. What is our goal? What is the only thing we can do that we established yesterday, and almost every day we talk about in some form, is to take the reddest states in America, elect Freedom Caucus guys to the legislature and governor, and interpose against federal tyranny, you know, build almost a parallel economy, currency, freedom, all of it. Okay? Demographically, deal with illegal immigration. Obviously, it's one of the top things we need to do. They're everywhere, by the way. Everywhere. Lots of news about them flooding states like Tennessee. Red areas, too, that you wouldn't think. So we need to deal with it. But unless we change our strategy in dealing with the courts and get more aggressive even rhetorically, yes, rhetorically, talking down Republican judges. Every single thing that you and I want to do, and it's not going to be easy to elect enough people to do it, but we claw and scrape and rock climb that cliff. You get on the bottom, you finally get to the top. You know what's going to be waiting for you? The judicial oligarch to shove you off that mountain and make all the work we did terrible. I'll never forget when I had a friend of mine who was a big activist in North Carolina during the Tea Party era, and she was in tears when we spoke about the courts screwing with their voter ID law. And she was like, we worked years for that, all for nothing, for a freaking lie to create some sort of fundamental right to vote without a photo ID. I mean, it's just so absurd. Never forget, the same philosophy that we have, that we'd be stupid to expend our energy as a conservative media organization, movement, pressuring Democrats and the media rather than pressuring Republicans who want to be in good standing with conservatives. The same holds true about Republican judges. Okay, let's dispense with this notion that there's some sort of like machines behind some bench that is unapproachable. They go to events like everyone else. They're human beings like everyone else. They talk to people like everyone else. Okay, let's make it very clear. How come the courts gave us what is considered a very bold ruling on affirmative action and abortion? And when I say very bold, I mean like overturning a half a century of precedent. It's pretty bold. Yet they won't even overturn some relatively recent new things that are even more egregious, or sometimes they'll even, like we talk about a lot, tacitly expand upon them by allowing bad lower court rulings to stand, or sometimes themselves contributing to it. Let me give you a classic example. What is more egregious from a legal, historical, and constitutional standpoint? A right to abortion or a right to gay marriage? It's obviously a right to gay marriage, because abortion at the end of the day is a little bit of a negative right, because, you know, they're asserting it's part of my body and I just don't want to be criminalized for, you know, having an abortion. Whereas with gay marriage, it's like you're saying a state has to recognize, has to redefine a fixed institution to give you something that is exclusively a state benefit. You're the one, you're not saying, look, just leave me alone. See, with abortion, the state wants to criminalize it. Here, you're the one asking for a status. Meaning, the equivalent would be more of like an anti-sodomy law. But we're not talking about that. You could go have sodomy all you want. It's just you're saying you want a state benefit that doesn't exist, when 2 years prior to Obergefell and Windsor, Kennedy himself said states have full authority since our founding. What's more deeply rooted in history and tradition? Gay marriage or abortion? Abortion, for sure. You know, it was illegal in the 1800s, but for, you know, in the 1900s, they really started to do it. Gay marriage was unheard of until 2000. Yet in Dobbs, they established a deeply rooted in history and tradition, or reaffirmed that litmus test, that standard for creating an unenumerated right that's subject to strict scrutiny for a state to regulate. And yet, notice, everyone agrees you would likely only have Alito and Thomas to overturn Obergefell. Why? Because it has nothing to do with the raw legalities. It's all political. We have created on the right a political movement that, at least if you're a Republican judge in good standing, there's something for them to latch onto. Affirmative action and abortion. Some other things. Gay marriage? Pfft. Where do you ever hear on the right anyone pushing for that? Commensurate with how much you pressure judges, And when I say pressure, I mean all of it. Conservative media, writing about it, naming them, naming these judges who screw us. They don't want that. And then again, governors getting together and delegitimizing, say, a court has no authority. Court has no authority over this. And making it clear that you might not listen. You can always back down and give in. But what I'm trying to tell you is, if you do all of this, delegitimize judicial supremacism, all this, they will back off. But anyway, I kind of got to my solution before the problem. But what happened yesterday in oral arguments in Alliance Hippocratic Medicine v. FDA? So on the merits, there's no doubt that the FDA's approval of mifepristone in 2000 and its subsequent expansions in 2016, 2021 were all unlawful. Okay? So again, it's not just because, oh, we don't like abortion. No, we don't. But legally, there's a bunch of Texas doctors, Alliance Hippocratic Medicine, pro-life doctors, that have said, look, this is a drug that is very dangerous. It was very novel. And it was approved through the wrong process. They might have been able to use another process, but they used what was called subpart H. It's a section of law for FDA authority. But that approval is only reserved for a drug that treats serious or life-threatening illness. Meaning it was, what do you think it means? Like cancer, right? That's what that kind of short circuit process. Now, this is a very important case. You know, look, I'm actually a little bit, you know, a pariah on the right in the sense that I think we need to focus on some other issues, like as our lead cause more than abortion. But this is the point of this is not about abortion. The point of this is the hypocrisy of the Republican judges on outcomes, on rules of standing, and also on FDA authorities. That's very important on this deference to the experts. There's a lot of important things to unpack in these oral arguments, but I'm just going to give you just a brief synopsis. So anyway, this drug was, you know, to treat serious illness. So now be like, well, what illness? The only way to have approved an abortion drug is to say that a pregnancy is an illness. And that's absurd. In fact, it's so absurd that Judge Jim Ho, who was one of the Fifth Circuit judges who, you know, ruled to strike down the FDA approval of this drug, he noted that Population Council, which was the entity that sought approval in 2000, they actually protested the government using this process because they said, quote, neither pregnancy nor unwanted pregnancy is an illness. And therefore, they were concerned that the courts would strike it down. That's the irony. And these idiots refused to do it. And then what happened was in 2016 and 2021, so originally they approved it. They said, look, we're going to have adverse event reporting. Same thing as COVID, by the way, as the COVID shots. We're going to, you know, you're going to have a doctor's visit, all these gestational limits of when you could use it. Subsequently, 2016, 2021, they took that all off. You could use it any stage, mail in without seeing a doctor in person, all this stuff. Remember, it is also important to understand that we're always fighting yesterday's issue. So they give us a Dobbs, but now most abortions are going to be chemical drug abortions. So this is, if that is your big issue, which is not my top issue, just for a variety of, you know, philosophical reasons, I'm just like, they're killing us, so I'm going to expend my capital protecting myself. You know, I'm almost, I know this sounds horrible, but I'm almost at the point of like, just kill your own people, leave me alone. You know, if that's going to be such a political liability relative to everything else, again, that's a long conversation. But my point is that if abortion is your issue, this is, you know, if the court rules against us on this is a big problem. Because Dobbs is going to increasingly become moot. And that's a whole other thing, that even when we get a good ruling, notice how they don't police it. Now, this is a little bit different, but remember we talked about that Virginia case with affirmative action, that they're making an end run around having admission standards to schools based on race. They just don't call it race. And the Supreme Court refused to grant the appeal from the students. So these judges are pathetic. But the reason is they only get pressure from one end of the political debate. And make no mistake, it's all political. It is all political. So anyway, bizarrely, it took 23 years, April 7, 2023, at the BS to pro-life doctors, a federal district judge, Matthew Kaczmarek of the Northern District of Texas, ruled that the entire FDA approval was unlawful. Again, it's not just politically we don't like abortion. This is an important, if you believe in judicial oversight of executive agencies stepping outside of statutory bounds, it was very legitimate for a court to rule that. It's nothing to do with whether you like abortion or not. I mean, obviously the plaintiffs didn't like abortion, but that's immaterial to the ruling. Because this has a lot of bearings on a lot of issues that we're dealing with, like the COVID shots. And I know ICANN, our friend Del Bigtree, has another lawsuit on FDA approval of a decongestion drug, something totally different, that they cite COVID as an example, as a precedent for using animal trials. And this is a big problem. You know, a lot of us believe in deregulation, but remember, we have regulatory capture. This is a very important point. In general, I would rather devolve things to the private sector, but we have a very strong FDA when they want to be strong. So it's regulatory capture. We don't have the ability to police safety of products because the FDA has a monopoly on it. So we rely on them. So it's a very big problem when the FDA now green lights dangerous products and we have no way around that. So this is not just abortion. You know, if you're listening and you're like a big abortion Karen, just understand that these are safety issues. I mean, Democrats forever were complaining that there's not enough regulatory oversight over FDA approvals for food safety, other things. They were into it before, you know, became cool. So nobody could argue that the entire approval was unlawful. Anyway, it went before the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit did a partial reversal, partial upholding. They basically said, nah, we're not going to strike down the original approval of the drug, but we are going to strike down the 2016-2021 expansion of making it available at all terms of gestation and, you know, without an in-person doctor's visit, among a couple other things. So Judge Jim Ho had a partial dissent in which he agreed with the district court that it should fully be uprooted. Fine. Okay. So right off the bat, I pointed this out in December when the court agreed. The court granted cert to overturn the good part of the Fifth Circuit ruling, but not the bad part. Classic hypocrisy, where they only grant the bad guys' appeals, not our appeals. So it's like, all right, maybe just take it up all together. No. So clearly, there's no chance they're gonna take Judge Ho's side and overturn the Fifth Circuit on not overturning the original approval, but we could only lose out that we won't even get the Fifth Circuit's ruling to overturn even the expansion. And indeed, yesterday we had oral arguments, and they seem to indicate exactly that. Now, as always, Kavanaugh, Barrett, and sometimes Gorsuch, in this case Gorsuch is included, they want to find out, they want to find ways that will allow them to give bad rulings without giving bad rulings. So what's a great way to do it? Oh, you don't have standing. So, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that happened. Justice Jackson basically said we need to defer to the experts. We shouldn't be second-guessing the experts, which is interesting because this is a woman, if you remember, who said during her confirmation that I'm not a scientist, I don't know what a woman is. So this is the new thing that governmental agencies could now go ahead and just do whatever the hell they want. And we just, well, it's medicine. But again, this has nothing to do with medicine. I mean, it happens to be, it's dangerous. It happens to be, it's on the freaking on the label of the FDA that between 2.9 and 4.6% of women will end up in the emergency room. It's on the FDA label. Okay, so even if you're pro-abortion, this is a dangerous drug. The manufacturer admits that between 100,000 and 350,000, 2-7% of users require surgery due to adverse events. This is a really big problem. Again, over and beyond abortion. You don't need to be a doctor to listen to their own statement and the FDA's label. But nonetheless, you don't even have to get into the whole debate over safety and efficacy of drugs. It was the only way you could say it was lawful is to say that pregnancy is an illness and that that's mentally ill. But that's part of the whole mindset. Now, these guys don't want to go be sound like Justice Jackson, so they play games and they said they didn't like the standing. Justice Gorsuch said there's been a rash of sweeping court injunctions in recent years. A prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action. So, you know, again, I'm sympathetic in a vacuum to like, yeah, you know, we don't want to turn the, you know, courts to a super legislature to basically determine the validity of every major public policy issue decision decided by the political branches. Now, I will just say that even in my sympathetic nature, there is a difference between, you know, the legislature and the executive branch together versus an executive agency clearly stepping out sort of outside of its statutory bounds. That more is, you know, the job of a court versus, let's say, you know, the legislature clearly did this, but you feel it's unconstitutional or whatever. But I'm sympathetic. Justice Barrett and Kavanaugh, same thing. Barrett said, so if that's right, I mean, I think the difficulty here is that, at least to me, these affidavits do read more like the conscience objection is strictly to actually participating in the abortion. And I don't think, you know, Scop and Francis, the doctors, plaintiffs, ever participated. In other words, what do you care? What do you care, guys? What do you care? You know, so you don't like abortion. There's a conscience protection. You're not going to have to do it. You're not going to have to prescribe these drugs. How does it affect you? Now, some of you who are smart onto this, you might be jumping out of your seats. But this really pissed me off. If you want to go back to strengthening Article 3 standing the way it was in 1789, that you have to have a very valid, ripe, particularized, tangible injury in fact to be a plaintiff, you can't just have some kind of subterfuge to put a political issue in the courts because you disagree with it politically, that it has to be a clear, you know, stakeholder in it. I'm very sympathetic to that. I generally think that's where the court should be. But let's apply it evenly. My gosh, these idiot judges are nowhere for us when the left wing does this to us on labor, environment, immigration. We have foreign nationals getting standing. And I want to point out two examples of how they're never there for us. Environmental issues, okay? There is something called aesthetic injury. There's a doctrine of standing called aesthetic injury, where basically any random plaintiff can assert that they will no longer be able to look at a plant or an animal as a result of, you know, an EPA or Department of Interior reg, meaning they feel they need to police, you know, Endangered Species Act more or whatever it is. And this is from Lewin v. Defense of Wildlife, 1992 case, the desire to use or observe an animal species, even for purely aesthetic purposes, is undeniably a cognizable interest for purpose of standing. This is true particularly for those... So, that was a quote. And the person who observes or works with a particular animal threatened by a federal decision is facing perceptible harm. Meaning, if you're like a scientist or a zoologist, so... you totally have standing. So a doctor should be the same thing. Look, you know, again, if you want to apply it strictly, I could respect not granting standing here. But based on the standing doctrine that these same justices continue to uphold when the left sues our policies, it is absurd to say that doctors who are actively practicing cannot assert that the FDA used an unlawful process to approve a drug that is very dangerous. Then there's something called offender observer standing. You know the whole line of establishment clause cases where they sue and say that the government ever like mentioning Christmas or having a replica of the Ten Commandments, it violates the establishment clause. Now, obviously, that's absurd. It doesn't. But even if it did, you might be wondering, how the hell do you get standing? How does the existence of a tenth of a Ten Commandment replica harm you? Mine eyes! It hurts my eyes! Like, what is it? It doesn't do anything. Like, literally, how do you ever get standing? And there's millions of cases. They get random atheist, satanic, or whatever plaintiffs that have nothing to do with it to get standing. I have one example I wrote about years ago, Felix v. City of Bloomfield, a 10th Circuit case where they ruled that the city of Bloomfield, New Mexico, had to remove its replica of the Ten Commandments on the city hall lawn. Now you might be wondering, well, how do they get standing? Here's what the 10th Circuit said. While Bloomfield argues that past exposures, meaning like exposure that I have to look at the, see the existence of this 10th Commandment monument, does not create imminent injury, the facts found by the district court establish ongoing injuries and charges to plaintiff's behavior. Oh, sorry, changes to plaintiff's behavior resulting from the highly visible religious display. Felix, he's the plaintiff, stopped going to City Hall to pay her water bills so she could avoid the monument, but still sees it from the road 5 or 6 times a week. Kuhn, another plaintiff, drives past the monument 3 or 4 times a week and sees it up close every month when he goes to pay his water bill. That kind of exposure is more than enough for standing. I promise you I'm not making that up. That's a verbatim quote from 10th Circuit. And in 2017, when the city appealed to the Supreme Court, they denied the appeal and sided with the 10th freaking Circuit. So folks, this is where we are. The same bastard courts that just reached in officiously to screw with Texas defending themselves from an invasion, they're like, look, guys, hands off the FDA. Don't tell them what to do, even when it's clearly dangerous and unlawful. Oh, you know, you don't have standing. Doctors don't have standing. Are you freaking kidding me? I mean, look, if you want to say that in this circumstance, doctors don't have standing, that would pretty much throw out the left-wing lawfare on environment and so many critical issues. I am all for making that deal. The problem is these bastard judges, and yes, Barrett, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh are hypocritical bastards. They will never apply it evenly because they're all political and because they feel the pressure from one end and the right never pressures them. We need to call them out. We need to pressure them. Governors need to start legislating and signing laws in accordance with our values, regardless of what they think they're going to rule. And it's time we tell them to get off our lawn. I'm telling you, they are prone to pressure. Remember, there's a reason why the Supreme Court did a reversal in 24 hours, and rather than putting an injunction on SB4, they're like, well, we don't want to do it, but wink and nod, we want the Fifth Circuit to do it. Because this is an issue that's becoming like abortion, you know, the invasion, and they're feeling the pressure. This is the sort of stuff we need a movement to think of, but because I'm just telling you, strategically, we got a big problem. We need answers. What are we going to do when you have a Supreme Court that is a one-way ratchet on every doctrine, whether it's merits, whether it's standing, whether it's rules of, you know, orders and motions and preliminary injunctions, administrative injunctions, or administrative stays, where it's all outcomes-based. That they basically have a scorecard. Oh, well, we did the Harvard case, we did Dobbs, we did Bruin. Well, now we can't rule with you on these cases. The courts are a very big, big problem. I'm just going to tell you, again, if Trump were to somehow become president, and he were somehow to have the most effective legal advisors and cabinet members, okay, no one could disagree with what I'm saying here. Everything he would accomplish would be executive. There's nothing you're going to do through Congress. We already proved that. So I'm just going to tell you, the left is going to assail all of them. Let's say there's 100 cases. They will all be illegitimate lawsuits. But Barrett and Kavanaugh and the likes will make sure to side with them, either explicitly or through the shadow docket, not taking up, you know, strategically taking up and not taking up appeals at their whims, at least 50% of the time, if not more. I'm telling you. Because remember, it's going to be even worse because, you know, to the extent we have a Republican president, it's going to be Trump at this point. Trump appointed them. So they're going to want to, they're certainly not going to want to look like they're rubber stamping the man that appointed them. That's how they think. Trust me, that is the psychology of these judges. They are prone to pressure every bit as much as these Republican governors that we refuse to expose to pressure. Now, it's a little bit different because it is life tenure and there is no primary. It's a little bit different, but again, pressure does work. They're human beings. And it's time we play the pressure game on the courts the same way the left does, rather than unilaterally disarming. I understand in a perfect world, we want the court to have its jurisdiction, us to have ours, follow the law, no politics. That ended years ago. The left has weaponized it beyond belief. So if the courts are not going to be there for us to protect us when the feds and the blue states screw with us at a political level, you better believe we're going to want to secure what we do politically in the red states. Because if we don't do that, there is quite literally zero hope. I want to end with this point. I still believe the most likely scenario is that Biden will win. Or if they swap him out with someone else, Democrats will win. Unless something changes, down ballot, this is clear. Nobody argues. No pollster argues. Polls all say that. It's a pro-Democrat environment. And there's a reason for that, because of the stupidity of the right. But, you know, you cannot imagine the mandate they will think they have and the things that they're going to do where they have power. So therefore, you cannot imagine the things we're going to need to do in red states. And I'm just going to tell you, almost everything the Biden admin would do, hypothetically, next year, will be upheld by the courts. And almost everything we want to do to protect ourselves will be struck down. Now, again, some will be the courts, some will be the lower courts. They'll play games. But they will strategically make sure that's how it works. Don't doubt me. This is what's happening in the courts. A lot more political news I want to get to. Again, we'll talk to tomorrow. We'll have a special guest on about the WHO, medical freedom movement, where things stand, what we can do in the states. But again, the courts are going to loom large in anything we want to do. Let me know your thoughts. Daniel Hurwitz at StarMail.com. Till tomorrow, God bless y'all, and thank you for listening.